Will Rogers, Ambassador of Goodwill, Prince of Wit and Wisdom. Chapter 4. Rogers on the Stage. After the fun and excitement of traveling with the circus in the Antipodes and the Orient, the thought of staying on the range, punching Oklahoma cattle, was not very appealing to Will Rogers, and he longed to be on the open road, showing his skill to an applauding crowd. As he expressed it, "I was spoiled by that time. It seemed plumb unnatural to punch cows without an audience." Even though he returned home broke, he found something to laugh at in the experience years later when he was a success on Broadway and his earning capacity far greater than the most avarious dreams of his youth. "Guess I've got a claim to the round-the-world booby prize," he declared, as it had taken me almost 3 years to land in Frisco broke. The moral of the story is, always get a round-trip ticket. It's cheaper in the long run. Zach Muhall of Oklahoma was organizing a Wild West show at the time. Will returned from his travels and signed on. The outfit trooped through the Southwest and then went to the World's Fair in St. Louis in 1904. Among Will's fellow troopers were Tom Mix, Zach Miller, later the owner of Miller Brothers' 101 Ranch Wild West show, and Lucille Muhall, the boss's daughter and the first woman rodeo performer. The following year, the outfit moved into the old Madison Square Garden in New York to give the Effete East an exhibition of real riding and roping. 26-year-old Will was the star roper of the show, and he had the opportunity to show that it was more than mere showmanship. Ropes Wild Steer. One night, one of the steers used the roping act, ran wild, and jumped over the railing of the arena into the crowd. As the frightened spectators dashed up the stairs, the steer was about to charge into them. Rogers, who had seen the animal start its mad dash, coiled up his lariat as he ran across the tan bark. Swish! The snaky coil of manila flew through the air and settled over the head of the enraged animal. Will dug the high heels of his cowboy boots into the tan bark and leaned back on the rope. He choked all of the fight out of the steer and then led him back to the temporary corral in the garden. The next day, Will Rogers found himself proclaimed a hero on the front pages of all the New York newspapers. After reading the accounts, Will was seized with a new ambition, and that was to stay in New York. When the Muhall show left town, Rogers remained behind looking for a vaudeville booking. But single cowboy acts were unheard of, and it was tough sledding before he was finally hired to do a supper show at the Union Square Theater. The supper show, Rogers explained afterwards, meant that all the big acts did two shows a day, and the little ones an extra at supper time between 6 and 8, when nobody that had a home or somewhere to eat would be in the theater. In vaudeville, Rogers did not take his audience by storm at the outset. He trooped on the Claw and Erlanger circuit, opening and closing the shows. He was strictly a dumb act. He had yet to find his greatest talent was in the ready wit with which he amused stagehands and fellow players. Rogers starts to talk. Many persons have claimed that they were the first to persuade Rogers to change from a dumb part to a monologue. Most of the claims, however, were without foundation, for above everything else, Will Rogers was inherently a showman. In his vaudeville days, he used to put on his act and then stand in the entrance to the stage, studying the other acts that were put on. He was in love with the theater, and he wanted to excel in it. It did not take him long to realize that laughs, not physical skill, produced the most money in show business. Rogers was not long in realizing that what he needed in his bit was a few wisecracks. It probably happened that Rogers missed one of his tricks at a performance, and to fill in the awkward pause that followed before it was repeated, he attempted a quip over the mishap. Many performers in vaudeville intentionally miss tricks for the express purpose of making some comment, and it was not likely that Rogers was slow in adopting their technique. He was, however, modest and shy to an extreme, and that may have held him back for a time, but eventually he added more and more talking to the act. It did not catch on with audiences at the start, and sometimes he was content just to present his roping act. In his early act, Rogers used a lariat, a white horse, and a rider as properties. As the orchestra played Cheyenne, Will would shuffle down to the center of the stage with a rope in each hand. The horse and rider would come galloping out of the wings across the stage, and in the twinkling of an eye, Rogers would throw the rope in his right hand around the horse and the one in his left hand around the rider. It was a difficult trick, but it was executed so swiftly that the spectators could not appreciate what had happened. A fellow actor told Rogers that if he would stop the music and make a brief explanation of what he intended to do, the stunt would appeal more to the audience. At the next show, Will walked out and held up his hand. "Stop that noise," he said. The audience roared with delight. Will Rogers had made his first wisecrack from the stage. "Folks," the cowboy continued, "you can see I got one of these ropes in each hand. When the hoss and the rider come out, I'm going to try to throw one of them over the hoss and the other over the rider." Again, the audience burst into laughter. Will was angry. He had not meant to say anything comic. "They laughed at me," he declared, as other players assured him that he had made a hit. "Sure they laughed," the actors replied. "You were funny." "Funny? Say, I can speak English as good as those folks out there. No, no, I'll never open my mouth again." For 5 years, Will Rogers and Company played in vaudeville for contemporarily meager salaries. The and company consisted of Buck McGee, Horseman, and Teddy, the White Horse. "Sometimes Bill used to make wisecracks at me as I stood in the wings," Buck said, "and often they were heard by those in the first two or three rows of the orchestra. They always laughed, and I tried to get Bill to talk louder, but he was bashful. One day a theater manager, wondering what was going on, stood beside me, and he got a lot of laughs, too. 'Why don't you put that out to the audience?' he said." Rogers, thinking he meant the roping loop that he was spinning over the audience, explained that it was the longest rope he had, but he'd try it sometime. The quip that failed. But once a wisecrack made by Will was misunderstood by the audience. It happened during his early vaudeville days when he was booked to play in a London music hall. During the act, Rogers ventured some remark about the English having tea in mid-afternoon. The audience thought it was profaning one of their most sacred customs and hissed and booed. Will retired in confusion. A short time later, in the lift in his hotel, Rogers met a fellow American and greeted him. "Howdy. You're from the States?" The stranger replied, "Yes. I saw your act this afternoon at the music hall." "It was pretty awful, wasn't it?" replied Will. "I didn't know I was roping in one of their sacred cows, and they can have all the tea they want without me butting in again." That incident may have been the father of the joke that Rogers used to tell of his vaudeville days. "I did the roping, and Buck McGee rode our trained trick pony, Teddy. He was a trick pony because he could do on a slippery floor what other ponies did on the range. That was because we had rubber galoshes built for the hoofs. Buck used to say he was the lucky one in the act because if the audience got after us, he had the horse to get away on. So I said to Buck, 'If the audiences ever get up at us, I'll give you and Teddy half a mile start and pass you. Teddy's boots is to help him stop fast. Mine is built to help me go fast.'" On Big Time. It was in 1912 that Will Rogers first definitely put his individuality over a Broadway audience. That year, he was one of six cowboys in an act at the Victoria. He had been talking off and on during his wanderings in vaudeville, but this was the first time that a big-time audience appreciated the significance of his drawling humor. This particular evening, Will missed lassoing the pony as it came galloping across the stage. "Wall," he drawled, "if he had stuck out his tongue, I'd sure enough caught him." The response was spontaneous and uproarious. The Oklahoma drawl registered, and the grinning, homely cowboy had come into his own. When the next season opened, Will Rogers was doing a single without the galloping pony and rider. His monologue lasted 45 minutes in contrast to the ordinary vaudeville turn, which was not allowed to run beyond 12 minutes. He kept his audience roaring with his sallies, anecdotes, and shrewd, homely philosophy. He was so good from the beginning on Big Time that many thought he was just a smart, clever actor who had created a character role. One of his favorite stunts in those days was to burlesque the act of a famous headliner, Anna Eva Fey, who enjoyed wide reputation as a mind reader. Rogers generally followed her on the bill, and her mind readings furnished him with a splendid material for good-natured fun. Will would pick out celebrities in the audience and proceed informally to tell their fortunes. Sunday night was the big night for the vaudeville at Hammerstein's because all of the legitimate theaters were closed. All the satellites of Broadway's nightlife would sure to be there. Among them would be Diamond Jim Brady, Lillian Russell, Jess Lewishin, Edna McCauley, Dick Canfield, Todd Sloan, Julia Sanderson, the Schneck Brothers, and hosts of other widely known nightlights. Mind reading. Rogers did not know any of these at the time, but with the unerring sense of showmanship that was his, he procured their names before the show from a friendly ticket speculator who had sold the celebrities their choice seats at a heavy premium. For an hour before he went on the stage, Rogers would question stagehands, managers, friends, and other actors about the persons whose names he had. On the stage, he would mystify and often confound these persons by mentioning where they had been the night before, what ladies the bachelors were paying attention to at the time, how much they had won or lost at the track and card table. As he recited this gossip, he would have a spotlight thrown on the notable he was discussing. Occasionally, he would have the spotlight fall on some celebrity only to pass him by without a word of comment. It was done for a joke, but there were no more uncomfortable person along Broadway than the expectant one for whom Rogers had no comment. This always produced as much a laugh as if he had retailed a choice bit of gossip. In those old vaudeville days, Rogers used to glance over to the old Amsterdam Theater, where Florence Ziegfeld was just about to make his name in the theatrical world as the producer of Beauty and Talent. Rogers was walking along 42nd Street with a friend one night, and as they passed the Amsterdam, the friend remarked, "One of these days your name will be up on that marquee in lights of 100 candle power each." "Quit kidding," retorted Rogers. "There's 10 letters in my name, and that would take 1,000 candle power. There ain't that much candle power in the whole doggone state of Oklahoma." Ziegfeld scouts, always on the lookout for a new talent, suggested that the entrepreneur procure Rogers for the Follies, but Ziegfeld only laughed at the thought. At that time, Leon Errol and George White were producing the dances, Nora Bays and Grace LaRue were the singing stars, and Kay Laurel, the toast of Broadway, was Ziegfeld's Little Venus. Ms. Laura was later married Winfield Sheehan, who was to become Rogers' guiding genius in the talking motion pictures. The scouts persisted that Rogers would go great in the Follies, and Ziegfeld signed him on. It was the beginning of a great friendship, and Rogers remained with Ziegfeld from 1914 to 1924, except for a brief period when Will went into the silent movies. Rogers never signed a contract with Ziegfeld or with anyone else on Broadway. "My word is good," Will said, "and the other fellers ought to be too." An example of Rogers' spontaneity was based on his long career with the Follies. Following a polo game at Santa Monica, a fellow player admired Will's physique as he prepared to take a shower. "Boy," said the player, "you've sure got a great pair of legs on you." Rogers' blue eyes twinkled, and with a roguish grin, he replied, "Why do you think Ziegfeld kept me in the Follies all those years?" Broadway star. Will Rogers starred in both the Follies and Ziegfeld's Midnight Frolics on the roof of the New Amsterdam Theater. In that small roof garden, Rogers said he did some of the hardest work of his life. And that was due to the fact that the clientele of the roof was made up of a relatively small group that came back night after night. Rogers, in consequence, changed his routine almost nightly. The changing of his monologue also had the effect of making the repeaters want to come back nightly to hear his latest quips. There was one quality about Rogers that no comedian of the stage was ever able to equal, and that was the fact that he never repeated a gag. While others told and retold the same stories, Will made up new ones as he went along. Some were pretty sour, as he expressed it, but the bulk of them were pretty good. When he was away from New York, Ziegfeld had a habit of firing telegrams at his stars. Will received scores of them, but paid no attention. At one time, Ziegfeld bombarded Rogers with a bunch of telegrams, but the Oklahoman did not answer any of them. The telegrams increased in length and warmth of language. Rogers stopped them by sending the following wire: collect. Keep this up. Am on my way to buy more Western Union stock. Friendship for Ziggy. When Ziegfeld was dying, it was reported that he was on an obscure ranch in Arizona fighting to regain his health. The great producer, however, was not in Arizona, but in California on the Rogers Ranch in the Santa Monica Canyon. There, the best physicians attended him, and everything was provided for his recovery and comfort. Ziegfeld was surrounded with every luxury to which he had become accustomed to in his palmiest days. Rogers saw that he had everything that money could procure, and as he expressed it, "Ziggy gave me my start. If there is anything I can do to repay him, nothing could be too much." When Billy Burke, one of the most famous actresses of her time, and the widow of Florenz Ziegfeld, heard of Rogers' death in the Arctic, she cried out, "I have lost the best friend a woman ever had." In his years with the Follies, Will Rogers became a sort of father confessor to that gathering of the world's most beautiful girls. He watched over them as a father and saved many of them from making a misstep by his homely counsel. He never sought the position of which the youngsters of the stage placed him, yet they all but worshipped him. Will had a theory that smoking cigarettes spoiled a woman's beauty, and he passed out packages of chewing gum, which he bought by the gross, to keep the pretty showgirls from using tobacco. He had a close companionship with his own lovely daughter Mary in those days, and once close friends approached him to dissuade her from choosing the theater as a career. He declined to interfere. "The more decent women the stage can get, the better it will be for the stage," Will replied. That chewing gum. While Will chewed gum on the stage and advocated for it for the chorus girls in place of cigarettes, he never chewed it in private life. Rubber bands were his specialty when he wanted to chaw something off stage. A funny story is told of a vaudeville that played in opposition to Hammerstein's when Will was on the way up. The opposition decided to put on a cowboy philosopher act, and a number of rope twirlers were rounded up. They were supplied with gags and pushed out on the stage to do their stuff. All of them failed dismally. "You know the reason," Rogers explained later. "They went out there and chawed tobacco instead of gum." Will Rogers did not always play the cowboy in leather chaps and Stetson hat. In one of the Follies, he essayed a feminine role in a burlesque of Lenore Ulrich, who was starring in Kiki. The sketch was entitled Cuckoo Nell. Speaking of that part, Will declared, "And if I don't go goo-goo myself some nights, it will only be because of the triumph of mind over matter. Those darn skirts are getting in my way all the time. I have worn the heaviest kind of chaps without difficulty. I have trampled for miles wearing a big old-fashioned overcoat made of buffalo fur, and I have played all kinds of engagements under the greatest difficulties, but I never knew what real trouble was until I tried to act in skirts. You see, the darned old things get in my way in such a manner that I forget my lines. I never did claim to be much of an actor anyhow." Wearing skirts. My little old act with the lasso was just put in to kill time while the girls were changing their costumes. A male actor's monologue in a girl show is just like an intermission. So I tried to make my act attractive by telling a few jokes, and the audiences laugh. And so Mr. Ziegfeld calls me a star. Telling jokes was all right, But when Ned Wayburn came to me a few weeks ago and said, "Bill, I'm adding a little dramatic sketch to the Follies and want you to act one of the roles," I said, "Well, if this guy isn't kidding me, I haven't anything to lose because I've got no reputation as an actor. And if I can make a hit, the critics will come out and say I am versatile and whatnot." You know what makes a critic? Two seats on the aisle. But I kind of calculated I could make these critics sit up when I came before them to do a John Barrymore. But then the blow fell. At the first rehearsal, I learned they wanted me to wear skirts. Now, skirts is all right in their proper places. Girls wear them, and sometimes the shortest ones are worn by old ladies. College boys wear them when they indulge in amateur theatricals. But to ask a he-man of the wild and woolly West to wear a skirt in a burlesque show kind of flappered me. I thought Wayburn was kidding me, and I said so. To kid him back, I said yes. But the darn fool meant it. He was in earnest. He brought out the manuscript for Cuckoo Nell and gave me the title role. When I saw I was really expected to play a girl's role and wear skirts, say the howling of a prairie dog at midnight was deep silence to what I said. But Wayburn insisted, said I had agreed in front of the whole company to play the role, and that my contract with Ziegfeld called me to play any role for which I was cast. I was roped, tied, and thrown, and that's how I got into skirts. Since I had to wear the blame things, I decided to make up as near like Lenore Ulrich and Kiki as I possibly could. So I saw that little actress at the Thursday matinee and ordered my costume built just like her first-class dress. The audience gets the idea of the burlesque at once, especially since Brandon Tynan, as David Belasco, is supposed to be rehearsing the act. I really tried at first to imitate Miss Ehrlich's voice, but no one could quite do that, so I imitated her mincing words and cute little business with the powder puff, and when I went on the first time, I thought the audience would throw things at me, but instead they howled. I didn't know whether they were laughing with me or against me, but so long as they laughed and didn't throw things, I had no kick coming. Now, after playing the darn fool role, I'm getting used to the skirts and the corset and the plumes on the hat, and I'm able to speak my lines without getting rattled. I am now studying the role of Ophelia and hope to play Juliet next season when all the other actresses have retired from the combat. Or if Miss Ulrich ever gets tired of playing Kiki, I'm willing to take her place if the public will let me. Meanwhile, I'll just keep on throwing the rope and telling my little jokes in the Ziegfeld Follies unless someone sends me poison candy for playing Cuckoo Nell in our little burlesque. It all goes to show that the real actor must be versatile. I never knew I was a real actor before, but it don't pay to quarrel with the critics, and since some of them called me an actor, I'm beginning to believe I am. First hit in the Follies. Rogers won his way into Ziegfeld's heart the first time he appeared in the Follies in 1914. The World War was raging in Europe, and there was no thought at the moment that the United States would ultimately become involved. Henry Ford, the automobile magnate, was planning to send a peace ship abroad with the intention of ending the war by Christmas, or as Ford expressed it, to take the boys out of the trenches. Twirling his lariat, Rogers let this one fly at the audience. "Ford's all wrong. Instead of taking along a lot of those high-powered fellers on his ship, he should have hired away all those Follies pins from Flo Ziegfeld. He'd not only get the boys out of the trenches, but he'd have Kaiser Bill and Lloyd George and Clemenceau shooting craps to see which one had the line at the stage door." That wisecrack is believed to be the first that Will Rogers ever made upon international affairs. Certainly, it is the first that was recorded as such. Eddie Cantor, blackface comedian who made his first big hit with the Follies in 1917, recalls that on his opening night, when he had gone over in a big way, he broke down and cried in the dressing room. One was feeling sorry that his grandmother, who had encouraged him when the days were blackest and who had only died a few weeks before, could not be present after their years of struggle. Will Rogers entered the dressing room, and Eddie told him why he felt so badly on the big stage on the biggest night of his career. "Why, kid, said Rogers. This is your big night. You're made. Take it big. Smile the tears away. After all, you're an actor. You know what's expected of you. 5 years later, Will Rogers telegraphed from California that he would like to be the toastmaster at a dinner given in honor of Cantor by the Friars, a noted club in New York City. At the function, he described Eddie Cantor as his favorite Hebe, and he went on to relate the story of Eddie's first big success. Meets Prince of Wales. In 1924, when the Prince of Wales was in America, Will Rogers was among those invited to meet him. On his departure, the prince sold a string of polo ponies he had brought to the country, and Will bought one for Patricia Burke Ziegfeld, daughter of his boss, but Ziegfeld supplied the money, according to Rogers. Writing of the incident, the cowboy comedian said, "It was reported in the press that I purchased one of the ponies for $2,100. Now, that was a mistake. I bought one, but it was for Mr. Flo Ziegfeld's little daughter, and it was him that paid for it. I have some alleged polo ponies of my own. In fact, I think I have the best string of $40 polo ponies in the world. So you would hardly get me given $2,100 for some old pony just because he belonged to the prince. I wouldn't give $2,100 for the crown, much less a horse. But anyway, it was a very nice, gentle, real kid's pony, and little Patricia Burke Ziegfeld was tickled to death with him. She had him following her all around, even into the house, and that made a big hit with Mr. Ziegfeld. So he told me, 'What do you know about that pony? Why, Patricia brought him right into the house.' I told him, 'Why, after the barns that pony has been used to while he belonged to the Prince of Wales, you were lucky to get him to go into your house. The pony must have thought he was slumming. That's the reason I didn't get one. I knew I could not support one in the manner in which he had been accustomed. By the way, the night after the sale, I met the prince over at a party given in New York by Mrs. Rumsey, and he come over and he thanked me for buying the pony, and commenced to tell me what a nice pony it was and all about it. Well, I didn't have the nerve to tell him that I had bought the pony for someone else. Incidentally, he asked me if I was not going to tell them some more jokes about him there that night. So I did tell all about the sale, and that now that the prince had sold his ponies, why, he could leave. That I thought that was all that the British would come over for. It was not to play polo, but to sell horses. Incidentally, there was a mix-up in where the check was to be sent, and that was what delayed his departure for a day. He had not received the money for the pony I bought. Maybe if I had not paid him at all, England would never have gotten their prince back." Loved to sing. Will loved to sing, but his high tenor voice was better suited for the lonesome reaches of the prairie than the theater. In one show of the Follies, the stage manager thought to have some fun with the Oklahoman and told him they had a song for him. Instead of refusing the part, as had been anticipated, he accepted gladly and went into rehearsal with it. Ziegfeld was convinced that the singing was the worst he had ever heard and ordered it stricken from the show, but Rogers insisted that it be kept in. With a great deal of misgiving, the song was allowed to remain in the show, but everyone was confident that it would ruin Rogers' reputation. On the opening night, Will sang the song and the audience nearly rolled in the aisles from laughing. Rogers, it should be explained, knew as Ziegfeld and the others that he couldn't sing, but he did know it would be good show business. It was just another demonstration that, above everything else, Rogers was a superb showman. Will Rogers had abandoned the stage for the talking pictures when his close friend, Fred Stone, crashed an airplane in Connecticut and broke both ankles just before he was to appear as a star in the musical comedy Three Cheers. It appeared as if the show could not be put on, and the large company that had labored for weeks in rehearsal would get nothing for their pains. Will dropped all of his plans and chartered an airplane for New York. After one day's rehearsal, Rogers stepped in for Stone's part, and the show went on. It was a tremendous hit, and not only added to Rogers' fame, but also introduced Stone's pretty daughter, Dorothy, to stardom. Charles Dillingham, producer of Three Cheers, paid Rogers with a blank check each week, which the comedian filled out himself. No one ever learned the amount of what Will took for himself. whatever the salary was, it did not make up for the financial sacrifice that Rogers made to help out one of his best friends. To take Stone's part until the latter was able to get back on his feet, Rogers canceled movie contracts that would have netted him close to $500,000. Friendship with Fred Stone. The friendship between Will Rogers and Fred Stone began outside the stage door of the Knickerbocker Theater in 1906 when Stone and his partner, Dave Montgomery, were co-starring in the musical comedy The Red Mill. That famous pair of comedians were rehearsing a new play entitled The Old Town, which was to open at the Globe Theater. Stone planned to do some roping tricks in the show and hired an Indian named Black Chambers to instruct him in the art. One day after a hard rehearsal, Fred Stone was sitting on a bench in the theater alley when a shy young man with an unruly thatch of hair and twinkling blue eyes came up and introduced himself. Will explained that he had heard that Chambers, who came from Claremore, Oklahoma, was teaching Stone roping tricks and that he wanted to greet his fellow townsmen. Stone told Rogers that Chambers was taken ill and it became necessary to send the young Indian back to Oklahoma. "I'm a roper," Rogers told Stone. "What are you doing, learning roping tricks?" Stone replied that all he wanted to learn was to spin a rope while dancing inside the swirling rope. "Shucks," Rogers replied. "I'll teach you all that roping you want to know." The two went inside the theater, and Rogers gave Stone a demonstration of handling a lariat as only the master could do it. That was the beginning of one of the finest friendships in the theater, and it grew with the years. Stone readily picked up the rope-spinning trick and used it for many years as a part of his routine in musical comedy. Will gave this testimonial of his friendship for the nimble-footed and versatile Stone, who was one of the greatest luminaries of his day. "When I agree to sing, that's the greatest evidence of sincere friendship I could show," Rogers declared. Rogers also learned to dance, but none of the thousands that paid to see and hear him, however, gave up their money to see him trip the light fantastic or hear him wobble through the popular ballads. They paid toll to listen to his latest jest. "It wouldn't be my luck for your father to be a dramatic actor," Rogers used to say to Dorothy Stone. "He had to be a dancer. That's tough, because I would like to take a crack at that Barrymore stuff. I know I could ruin a good drama. I had to take dancing lessons for this show," he would tell the audiences. "Taking up dancing at my age is like taking up golf at your age. But if I must say so, some of my dancing is just as good as some of your golf." Substituted own lines. When Rogers joined Three Chairs, the producers were smart enough to allow Rogers to substitute his own lines whenever he saw fit. No one else but Will could have conceived them, and their freshness and originality was evidenced by the fact that often the cast had to stop and laugh themselves. In Stone's show, Rogers made a lot of fun out of an operation he had undergone a short time before. He described how he entered the hospital and how one nurse after another came in, punctured the end of his finger with a bodkin to take samples of his blood. When the fifth blood pirate appeared in the room, Rogers waved her away and declared, "No more blood here. I believe you girls are keeping a friend who is anemic." A diagnostician, he explained in connection with his operation, was a traffic cop for physicians who directed patients to left-leg doctors when they really should be sent to right-leg specialists. Will's ad-libbing in the show forced the other players to be constantly on their guard. Andy Toombs, who himself was one of the great comics of the stage, avoided difficulty by learning Rogers' part as written by the authors. Incidentally, despite Rogers' joke about singing, members of the cast declared that the part Will enjoyed most was the place where he was called upon to sing a duet with Toombs. While Will Rogers was with the Follies before he became a featured star, the other luminaries on the bill frequently complained about the size of the type in which their names were displayed. After a rumpus over this point, one manager told Ziegfeld that he would never book the Follies for his theater again. Ziegfeld then declared he would cut all billing for stars and merely advertise the Follies. He broke this rule only for Rogers, and the cowboy philosopher was billed ahead of the show in this fashion. Will Rogers in Ziegfeld Follies. When Rogers first abandoned the stage for the movie pictures, Florenz Ziegfeld warned him to watch out for those movie cuties. Shucks, replied Will. If your gals couldn't break me down in all those years, what chance have those movies got?
Will Rogers, Ambassador of Goodwill, Prince of Wit and Wisdom, Chapter 5. Rogers in the Moving Pictures. Will Rogers was a stage star of the first magnitude when Samuel Goldwyn, the producer, persuaded him to quit Broadway to go into the movie pictures in 1919. The plays were far from being startling successes, but Goldwyn, with his uncanny sense of showmanship that boosted him to the top, realized that as a movie star, Rogers possessed a homely quality that would appeal to the masses. Goldwyn was ahead of his time, for the silent films could not reproduce the inimitable drawl with that multitude of inflections. To star in the movies at that time, the actor had to captivate the younger generation by his looks, and the cowboy philosopher, who looked as if he had just finished cutting his own hair with a pair of dull sheep shears, could not display his great personality to the best advantage. Early days in the movies. Rogers was asked in those early days how he happened to enter the films, and he replied, "When Goldwyn decided to make fewer and worse pictures, he sent for me." It was Rex Beach, brother-in-law of Fred Stone, who introduced Rogers to Goldwyn. Beach told the picture producer that Will was the man to play the part of Bill Hyde, hero of Beach's novel, which was being adapted for the screen by Goldwyn. On the screen, the picture became Laughing Billy Hyde, and Rogers played the title role. Rogers' own version of how he was approached on the subject of entering the moving pictures is a masterpiece of wit. "I've knocked all around the world," he said. "I was born in the old Indian territory, and I grew up on a cow pony, but I prefer to travel in a Pullman. I can shoot pretty straight, but I've got no notches in my gun. I never even shot up an ice cream parlor or a cigar store. Most of the Wild West stuff is pulled off in the big cities anyway. I didn't have any more intention of going into pictures than I had of being president of Yale. I was living quiet and peaceful down in Amityville, Long Island, where the insane asylum is, when Mrs. Rex Beach came driving down there one day. She steps out of her royalty on the spoilers and says, 'Will, you're going into the movies.' I pointed over to the place where they kept the lunatics and told her chauffeur that she had come to the wrong place. 'No, Will, I'm serious,' Mrs. Beach says. I told her my hair wasn't curly, that I couldn't roll a cigarette with one hand, and that I didn't aim to annoy more than one audience at a time. 'You've got to come, Will,' she insisted. 'The movies is the third biggest business in the world. Safety razors is first, corn plaster is second, and movies third.' Well, I went in. Since then, the movies has become the second biggest business in the country. Bootlegging is the biggest. The movies is the grandest show business I know anything about. It's the only place where an actor can act and at the same time sit down in front and clap for himself." Rogers told Goldwyn that he couldn't act, and when the producer offered him a contract, he replied, "You're waving that paper at the wrong boy, Mr. Goldwyn. Why, if I was to take up your proposition, you'd be the maddest man in the world before you got through with me." Laughing Bill Hyde was produced at the Goldwyn Studio in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and the picture made money for the producer, but nothing like the fabulous sums that were to pour into the coffers of the Fox Company when Rogers appeared in the talking pictures. After the first picture was finished, Goldwyn took Rogers to see it one day and said, "Now what do you say, Mr. Rogers? Are you an actor?" "Yep," replied Rogers. "You're right. I am an actor, all right. The worst in the world. My answer is still the same. Leaving the acting business to them that can act. All I know how to do is to throw a lariat and crack jokes." Rogers' estimate of himself was always modest in the extreme. He frequently told fellow actors that he could not act, and the only time he was any good was when they found a part that's sort of like me. He expressed a similar opinion of his skill with the lariat. "I'm the poorest roper in the world." But that was Rogers. As an actor, he essayed many roles and performed them with a rare skill that others could not imitate. As a roper, he was one of the best that ever appeared on the stage. In 1920, Rogers made Jubileo, and Goldwyn always was of the opinion that this film was the Oklahoman's greatest achievement in silent pictures. It was a melodrama in which Rogers played the part of a forlorn old tramp. Motion picture critics of the period accorded the film only casual notice, and the same was true of other films of the day. Regardless of the opinion of the critics, Goldwyn continued to star Rogers in silent films. They must have made him some money by proving popular with the movie fans of the day, for no producer would have featured a player in one film after another unless he brought in box office receipts. Among the silent pictures in which Rogers starred in were Almost a Husband, Honest Hutch, Jess, Call Me Jim, Two Wagons, Both Covered, Doubled for Romeo, Boys Will Be Boys, Family Fits, Our Congressman, The Headless Horseman, Going to Congress, Gee Whiz, Genevieve, and A Texas Steer. In those early days on the movie lot, an assistant director told Rogers that he would have to ride a horse in one of the scenes. The assistant then went on to explain that if he couldn't ride, a double would be provided for him. Will looked at the young man quizzically and asked, "Where's the horse?" On being shown the animal, Rogers leaped upon the back and cut across the lot in good old cowboy fashion. The assistant director, who had made the mistake of thinking Will was strictly a Broadway cowboy, stood open-mouthed as Rogers put the horse through his paces. Writes his own titles. In a film travelogue entitled In Paris, in which Rogers appeared in those days, the titles were written by him. Without the picture, the effect of many of them was lost, but some of the others were amusing by themselves. They were, "Well, folks, here we all are in gay Paris, but count on the French custom of throwing rocks at American tourists, I'm going to disguise myself as a frog." Will then put on a small, pointed black mustache. "Now, if your sightseers will all keep still and don't start bragging about where you come from, they'll never know we're Americans. Come on, folks, crawl into the Limberjack hack, and I'll show you the Claymore, Oklahoma of France. First, I'll show you the most thrilling spot in Paris, the place where Americans go every day to see if their friends back home have cabled the money. Here's the French Opera. If this was in America, it would be a movie house. This chateau on the right is the Café de la Paix, and if you are an American, you will. These saloons are so full, half the people can't get in, so they set them on the sidewalk. The Grand Boulevard, translated into Oklahoma English, it means main stem. Here's the Eiffel Tower. Charlie Schwab sold them the steel. Otis put in the elevators, and the Americans go up and look. It's a traffic tower for angels and airplanes. They call this the Latin Quarter because no one speaks Latin and no one has a quarter. These are the Tuileries, the most beautiful gardens. That thing spouting out is a fountain. If a thing was spouting at home, it would be a senator. The French have done very well with their art when you consider they use only two subjects, the nude woman and the lion, and even the lion is nude. This is the Louvre, France's great picture gallery. It's the nearest thing France has to our Hollywood. The Louvre has more art, but Hollywood has more excitement. Let me present Mona Lisa, the only beauty who went through history and retained her reputation. Returned to the stage. After 3 years before the camera, Rogers became convinced that the stage offered him the most medium of expression, and he returned to the New Amsterdam roof, where he opened his new act in a masked dance in which he impersonated a showgirl in the Ziegfeld Frolic. He wore a pair of pink satin slippers and a cape in his impersonation, but he presented the act only once in public. "I wore the pink satin slippers just once, and that was enough," Rogers said. "Besides, I think it was silly, even if people did laugh when I threw off my cloak." To fellow actors, Will confessed that he was glad to get away from the movie lots and return to the theater. "It's a great thing," he said, "to get the old brain working again after loafing on the movie lots. You know, you've got to exercise your brain just like your muscles. I found when I went back that I wasn't as good as I used to be. I was all out of practice." First talkie. When sound projection proved successful, Winfield F. Sheehan, then executive head of Fox Films, sought his bosom friend, Will Rogers, and persuaded him to return to take a chance on the talkies. "Ah, Winnie," protested Will, "I'll probably mess your picture all up." But Sheehan was of a different opinion, and Rogers went to Hollywood to make They Had to See Paris, which was produced in 1929. The picture registered as a smash hit throughout the country and immediately established Rogers as the leading box office attraction. Fox made about $700,000 profit on the picture, and Will's contract called for the production of another picture immediately. Before it was started, however, Fred Stone cracked up in his airplane. Rogers chartered an airplane and flew to New York to take his friend's part so that the show might go on. Aside from his great friendship for Stone, it was said that Rogers was motivated by the thought that more than 100 persons, actors, showgirls, and stage artisans would be thrown out of work unless the show went on. Three Cheers had a long run, and then one day Will Rogers faced the difficult task of playing Fred Stone while the veteran comedian was in the audience. Late in 1930, Rogers went back to Hollywood. The first picture he made on his return to Hollywood was So This Is London, and one of the uproarious bits occurs when Rogers is playing the role of a seasick passenger crossing the Atlantic Ocean. He was wrapped in blankets and seated in a steamer chair when a dizzy young thing noticed his misery and inquired airily, "Is this your first crossing?" Rogers looked up at her wanly from the depths of his coverings and replied, "Does anyone ever go again?" In famous roles. His next appearance on the talking screen was in the role of Bill in Lightnin', the character made famous by Frank Bacon on the legitimate stage. As Bill Jones, the lovable old inventor, Rogers had a part that in many ways was like himself. Bill, however, was a shiftless husband, and by no stretch of the imagination could Will Rogers have been found guilty on that score in real life, even in the smallest degree. In The Connecticut Yankee, a modernization and adaptation of Mark Twain's famous tale, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, Rogers was a radio engineer who was transported back to the days of the Knights of the Round Table after being stunned by an electrical outburst in a gigantic and mysterious radio set. In Mark Twain's original version, the first Yankee was carried back to King Arthur's time after being hit over the head in a fight with a fellow worker. In the filming of the picture, the question arose whether Will Rogers could be induced to wear tights. It was said that he objected in the beginning, and in the early scenes he wore his conventional blue overalls. Even in the jousting scene, when he might have been expected to appear like other knights, he insisted upon a costume of his own design, and it did not include tights. Near the end of the picture, when Will donned armor to go out and rescue the pretty princess from the wicked queen, he capitulated. When his captors denuded him of his iron shirt and pants, Rogers stood clad in tights. In the picture Young as You Feel, Rogers showed that he could not only wear clothes as well as any other great actor, but that he could play parts that were decidedly unlike himself in real life. Appearing first as the groaning dyspeptic who had set time by the punctuality with which he takes his pills, Rogers, as Lemieux Morehouse, throws off the cloak of illness and appears attired in the height of fashion, a checkered suit with a pearl-gray waistcoat, derby and spats to match, all designed for the racetrack, showed that Rogers got as much fun out of wearing fancy clothes as did his audiences at seeing him arrayed in all his glory. Will overcame his reputed aversion to evening dress and appeared in a faultlessly cut suit and a silk topper. All this went to prove that Will Rogers was a superb showman who clung to his careless manner of dress because it was his trademark and the finest kind of show business. In Business and Pleasure, Rogers was again called upon to play the part of a businessman, while in the play Ambassador Bill, he was a politician. Although there was nothing that savored of the Old West, he was allowed to just be Will Rogers in the picture's happy days. He was a plutarchic businessman in Down to Earth,
But in his next vehicle, too busy to work, he was a happy-go-lucky tramp. Next, he played the role of a farmer who specialized in hog raising in State Fair, and in Dr. Bill, he was a country doctor. Will was the proprietor of a fix-it shop in Mr. Skitch, and in David Harum, he was a banker and a horse trader, an actor of rare talent. Rogers, despite all his fun-making, was an emotional actor of rare talent. It used to be one of the favorite and moss-covered jokes of the stage that the low comedian always aspired to the role of the melancholy Dane. Rogers proved that it takes a great comedian to play an emotional part. During the filming of Judge Priest, he played the leading part in Ah, Wilderness on the stage, and when the show opened in San Francisco, he was accorded one of the greatest ovations ever given a star in that city. His performance of the sympathetic role, created by that other great comedian, George M. Cohen, was acclaimed by the dramatic critics as one of the outstanding triumphs of the stage. Rogers said that after all his years of comedy, he essayed the role in Ah, Wilderness as a personal experiment, and he really felt that he might be a notable flop. Frank Borzage, who directed Will Rogers in They Had to See Paris and Young as You Feel, expressed the idea very clearly. The one thing that made Will Rogers the outstanding comedian in the films was his own ability to make audiences forget that he was a comedian. This quality of his was very apparent in the scenes where Rogers was called upon to portray the simple human emotions that touched the very soul of mankind. The sincerity and conviction with which he did them is what might be expected of a great tragedian. Audiences forget Rogers as a wisecracker and think of him only as a human being torn with emotion. Rogers' death in the Arctic cut short a production schedule of 10 proposed pictures for the Fox Company. The humorist had signed to appear in 10 pictures at a salary of $200,000 each and had completed 3 of them. The 3 completed pictures were Steamboat Round the Bend, Doubting Thomas, both released shortly before the tragedy, and In Old Kentucky. There was some question raised about the propriety of releasing Rogers' pictures after his death. David Butler, motion picture director, who knew Will as the working man better probably than any other person, told this question. Rogers was deeply affected by the deaths of Newt Rockne, football coach at Notre Dame, and Marie Dressler, the film star. "You know, Dave," Butler recalled Rogers as saying when they were talking about Miss Dressler, "there is a permanent record of her on these talking pictures, and she'll always be with us. Don't worry, old Will himself will always be there, too, unless they get tired of me." Dressing room, a rumple seat. Will's dressing room was a rumple seat of his car, and many times he would come tearing up to the stage in his car or on location where we were working. If he'd be late, he'd yell, "Hold on there, boys, I'm coming." He'd jump out of his car, dash around the back, and don his pants and shirt, and in a second, he would be ready for work. He would never sleep in his dressing room as the other stars did. He'd hitch those old spectacles on at the end of his nose, slide down into a chair, his face hidden in a newspaper, pretending he was reading, but he would be snoozing. After a while, I would go over and tap him, and he would awaken with a jerk, clear his throat, and say, "Look here, Dave, did you read this story in the paper? Plum interesting." Butler declared that Rogers disliked learning the lines as written in the scenario. He would have Butler give him the general theme of the scene, and then the humorist would supply many of his own lines. Seldom did Rogers ask that the mechanical crew on his set work overtime, but whenever a picture was completed ahead of schedule, the comedian would make up the loss to the men by paying them out of his own pocket. In all, he made 19 talking pictures. None of them earned less than $1 million at the box office, and it has been estimated that he brought in more than $25 million to the treasury of the Fox Company while he was in their employ. On the movie lots in Hollywood, everyone loved Will Rogers, and nobody was jealous of him, which was, by the way, of being a miracle when the temperament of movie stars was considered. No upstage for Rogers. Never did he demand anything as the highest salaried star in the business. He spent half his time gabbling with the $5 and
$10 a day extras. Often they were just a tryout audience for some wisecrack that would appear in the next day in his daily writings or as a gag in his pictures. Scorned luxurious dressing room. While he talked, he chewed, sometimes gum, but mostly rubber bands or the tips of his spectacles. He claimed that 18 pairs of spectacles were chewed up every 2 years. Overall, high-heeled cowboy boots and an old sweater was his usual costume about the movie lots. He looked more like a cowhand than the greatest star. Rogers had the only reserved table in the commissary on the Fox lot. He invariably drank 2 cups of coffee, regardless of what he ate, and always paid the checks of all those who sat at his table. He scorned a luxurious dressing room, the studio fixed an adobe hut in the midst of a beautiful garden for him to occupy. The place had an electric kitchen and a living room adorned with Western and Indian trophies. Rogers looked in and said, "It is swell," and never went back until President and Mrs. Coolidge visited him. He ushered them into the house and later explained it by saying, "Well, they had to set somewheres, didn't they?" Every year, Henry Ford and Walter Chrysler presented Rogers with a new roadster or coupe, and he used it for an office and a dressing room. In the rumpel seat, he kept 12 ties, 2 suits of clothes, and a portable typewriter. That was his movie and literary equipment. When he was not working or eating in the company of restaurant, he would generally be found seated upon the running board of his automobile with his typewriter on his lap, writing a piece for the papers. Rogers' love of people. He was always on time, and after he had the action of the scene to be photographed thoroughly in his mind, he would ask what clothes he was to wear. Then he would go to his car, pick out a tie, or perhaps change a suit. Then he would work until noon, when he would call out, "Lunchy!" That was a signal for a dash to the restaurant, and he would be the first one there. His love of food was equaled only by his desire to travel and meet people. Rogers called the restaurant his club, and often he toured the room, stopping to chat for a moment with stenographers, script girls, extras, and others who earned only modest salaries. After passing the time of day with them, he would pick up their checks and pay for their lunches. When he was out on location, Will took a box lunch along and sat down with the mechanics, carpenters, and extras to eat it. When he returned to the set after luncheon, Rogers always took a half hour or more to grind out his daily newspaper feature. This finished, he would read it to the stage carpenter or a director. If their reaction was good, it would be sent at once to the telegraph office. About 4:30 every afternoon, Rogers would begin spinning imaginary ropes as a signal to the director that he was impatient to be off for his Santa Monica ranch to rope a few steers, a pastime which he never tired. Once he was playing in a scene in a late afternoon, and it was decided to continue it after supper. The action called for Rogers to take the same place as before. The camera was aimed at the back of his head. As they were about to shoot the scene, the director noticed to his horror that Rogers had his hair cut during the supper hour. The director explained to Rogers that it would be ridiculous to see long hair 1 minute and short hair the next. The picture was spoiled, he assured Rogers. Will grinned. "Shucks," he said. "If it's a good picture, they won't notice it, and if it's a bad, it won't matter." Rogers had very strict ideas of what he would do for the moving pictures. He wouldn't portray smoking or drinking, although he did not mind if other characters did it in his picture when such action was necessary to the plot. In Doubting Thomas, Will was supposed to take a cigar from his pocket and hand it to another player. He refused on the ground that he didn't smoke and the action would be unlike him. Visitors to Fox movie lots always asked to see Will Rogers first. If those making the request were prominent enough, they were presented to him, and during his career in movie-toned city, he entertained more celebrities than any of the others in Hollywood's royal families. A list of the notables were called upon him once would read like a selection of names from the front pages of the newspapers. While he was engaged in filming Business and Pleasure, he was visited by Patrick J. Hurley, then Secretary of War, Colonel and Mrs. Charles Lindbergh, David Ingalls, Secretary of Aeronautics for the Navy, Helen Wills, the tennis queen, Frank Hawks, the aviator, Florence Ziegfeld, Prince Svasti of Siam and his royal family, the Four Horsemen of Notre Dame football fame, and scores of others equally well known. Instead of taking the callers through the plant in his own car, Rogers took great delight in offering them the novelty of the studio's private transportation system. This was a bus with a uniformed driver. Luncheon was sometimes served in his dressing room. It was a mystery to many at the studio how a man who neither drank, smoked, played cards, golf, nor tennis could enjoy his fame as a host. The secret was in his conversational ability. Rogers even talked to himself, a habit that probably carried over from his cowboy days on the Oklahoma range. A weekend guest at the Rogers Ranch was a three-day show, with Rogers keeping up as a running fire of Western political, Hollywood, and darky stories. One of his unrealized ambitions was to make a picture in blackface. Rogers' death cut short a proposed production schedule of 10 pictures for the Fox 20th Century Company he had signed to appear in the films until 1938. Steamboat Round the Bend, which was released just about the time he died, was hailed by critics everywhere as probably his greatest picture. The character, as always, was Will Rogers, the movie actor, who in 1934 and 1935 was rated as the player who had drawn the largest number of patrons to the movie houses of the country. In the picture, Will again showed his rare ability of timing his scenes perfectly, of modulating his voice in the exact tone, and of emphasizing the humor with a spontaneity that made it appear as if acting were fun instead of the hardest kind of work. Irvin S. Cobb, who played with him in the picture, tells how Rogers magnanimously gave Anne Shirley, the pretty young actress who played the lead, her chance to shine in one of the important scenes. Cobb, the famous humorist and writer, was induced to play in the picture at the insistence of Rogers. Cobb told how Will drew John Ford, the director, aside during a lull in the play. "John," Rogers said, "this kid is good. She's swell. And she's a sweet little thing, off and on. Makes me think of my own Mary somehow. What say, let her dominate the scene instead of me?" Ford, according to Cobb, told Rogers that he was the star, and Will replied, "I'm getting the star's billing and the star's salary, but the star of this picture, man or woman, is the one that can steal it. Have a heart, John. Give the kid a chance." And John had a heart, Cobb declared.